Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Yes Sir HR. As usual, my name is Mark, and I am with...
Yes, it's me again, Dennis, in sunny Jersey, but a very cold Jersey, let me add.
Yeah, I saw the picture that you sent to our WhatsApp group, and I must say, I could feel the chills coming through the phone.
Yeah, I've just come in, actually, and I had to have a few minutes just to go...
Get the fire going.
I would warming up now. So was me.
Yeah, I'm already warmed up considering the fact that United have won their first trophy of the season. So that's good news. Yeah, I saw a little meme that says Harry Maguire has won a trophy ahead of Harry Kane.
Oh, right. Yeah. I thought you had a rub. I thought the first goal was off.
The deflection that Newcastle never had.
There you go. That's football, isn't it?
Yep, there you go. Okay, so enough of rubbing misery into your face. Today, we are going to talk a little bit about some of the key challenges. And maybe to focus a little bit on curriculum reduction. So I think what prompted us to talk about this was an article that you came across in the, was it the Jersey Times?
No, I actually quoted it in Jersey. I was actually, okay. Making reference to a major report in the UK that was quite right. Critical of aspects of the curriculum. And one aspect was that there's just too much stuff. And employers and students were not seeing the relevance of it. I mean, that was it. But so it's nationally recognised that there is some real need of curriculum reform in many sections of the UK curriculum. That's I don't think anybody questions that now. It's just a question of what's going to be done, when and how and by whom.
Okay, so let's maybe focus on that a little bit. An idea about what you just said. Too much curriculum, students, parents, and maybe even industry are not finding it relevant. So there's a conscious push towards reducing curriculum. And when we talk about curriculum, I think it's talking about content as the first part that goes. Firstly, is that a fair statement? And secondly, I think Singapore also has done that recently. But let's do the first part first. So when we say cutting curriculum, we are talking about content, right? And
yeah,
maybe
certainly we are we've only got to go back a few hundred years ago, and if you actually think about existed in the world then as compared to knowledge now, and this constant reference to exponential knowledge growth, well, okay, but the problem is we've still got a Stone Age brain, and it's probably not that different, according to some evolutionary biologists, it's not that different to what it was 300,000 years ago.
Keep on consent to the curriculum. It's just not...
Okay, so it's interesting that you say that, because I also noticed that you sent me some stats which I thought was quite interesting. And it says 75% of companies say they have had to give extra training in basic skills. Now, isn't that counterintuitive? The fact that we are cutting curriculum, wouldn't that suggest that would be expected? Because if you don't want the schools to teach what's important, then surely this will now, the burden will now fall on companies. Am I missing something here?
I think we've had
a number of conversational matters where we keep emphasizing not
better is better.
And this is a classic case of
what's that into our into the curriculum.
But it's not actually what is most important. So it's a little bit like, having a dinner of food that you don't like. They can keep saying, well, have some more, have some more, have some more. But if you don't like it and you're not finding it nutritious or tasty, it's not working. And I think that's the issue. It's not so much that
about massively reducing the amount of what we've been. And I think actually, we have in Singapore, learn more.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Yeah, I can. The reason why I can remember that was because I just started into my teaching career. And if I'm not wrong, it was around the late 1990s, before the early 2000s. And I remember it was talked about at the National Day Rally, which happens to be one of the most important speeches of the year, because it really sets the tone and direction for the country moving ahead. And I remember when the Prime Minister said that, teach less, learn more, everybody was like flabbergasted. They were like, what exactly does that mean? And I remember after that, there was a statement that came out that says, it's not just about cutting content, of which one of it was the key feature, but it also means focusing and freeing up this time to allow lecturers or teachers, whatever we want to call them, to spend time really working with students at the level that goes beyond what I would call instruction-based type of situations. And don't get me wrong, of course, this was in the late 1990s, early 2000s, way before John Hattie's idea of what high effect size methods. So the idea or thinking then was, let's reduce the constant face-to-face teaching, if I may, and focus a little bit more on looking at facilitating learning, helping students think more critically, and really helping them deal with complex problems and issues. Was that the impression that you got when you were in Singapore?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's got a number of features. It was a very clever statement because at one level, the curriculum needed to be trimmed in terms of the amount of content. Yep. Another thing I think was that, well, hold on a minute, we know a lot more about effective teaching. You know, you mentioned John Hattie's work, but I mean, prior to John Hattie, there's people like Bransford, Darling Ammon, Willingham, I think it was Mayer and Alexander, a lot of people doing a lot of work in cognitive psychology. And the basic notion was that we should be focusing more on teaching key concepts because they're more effective being retained in the brain and they're fundamental to understanding. And basically, if students get a good understanding, it even goes back to Jerome Bruner, who talked about the structure of a subject, that once a student understands the key structure, it's a lot easier then to build understanding. Just having lots of content in itself doesn't build understanding. So students can be, and it happens. And I think, you know, we've heard teachers say, I taught this last week and you haven't remembered it. The reason that students don't remember it is, well, some don't pay attention, right? So yeah. Let's not blame teachers on this. But if students are not learning the key concepts that's fundamental to understanding, then they don't develop it, providing their thinking, they won't get a good inference and interpretation, which is fundamental to understanding, isn't it? So teach less, learn more was, yes, let's reduce subject content that's not fundamental to understanding. Let's teach better and let's focus more on the learning process, not just content. I mean, this argument about, do we teach process skills like thinking more than we teach content? Well, the truth of it is, there's got to be a balance between the two. They're linked. There's no point in teaching thinking skills without content because that doesn't make sense. Equally, there's no point in students memorizing lists and lists of historical dates if they've got no understanding of historical analysis and what history is really about. Not just memory. I mean, I did A-level history and all I did is memorize lists of stuff, the Corn Laws, the inventions in the Industrial Revolution, and I just spat them out. I didn't learn anything about what history is about. I didn't get any meaning from it. It was just,
I did 2 years of that.
Looking back on it, I mean, the teacher did what good teachers did those days. They were able to dictate notes well. I mean, that was before the days of running notes off or technology or a big understanding of the way the brain and the mind works, clear dictation was a key teaching.
But some of the teachers
dictated it, and we didn't even understand it in just because they couldn't say it clearly, or the language was monotonous. So that's, you know, that's my frame on it.
Okay. So I think that now brings us to the point about when you were alluding to teaching just basic key concepts. Okay. So when we do that, and you just describe a similar experience that I had when you talk about learning history, and that is really just a whole point about memorizing a lot of dates, a lot of what people will be more familiar with in terms of knowledge. So I think there's a rising importance of shifting the thinking about the curriculum should focus a lot more on skills. And I think if you go back and look at the teach less, learn more concept, is really stop talking, stop filling people's head with knowledge, but focus on skills building. Now, what does that actually mean when we say skills building? And I know you did say that it is meaningless to ask students to do something along the lines of critical thinking if they don't have basic knowledge about the topic to be able to do critical thinking at off. Okay, but let's look at the idea of building skills versus knowledge. Would you say that has now evolved to that state now where skills are seen as a little bit more important and sexier than knowledge?
Well, a little bit more important, I would say fundamentally important. Sexy has multiple connotations, so I won't offer any frame on that one. But I get the connotation that it's more kind of attractive. Yeah, look, I mean, the thing is, the internet is full of knowledge, isn't it? But yeah. Because it's full of knowledge, it doesn't mean that you get skilled at anything. For example, if I want to know who played football for Kerr Alexander in 1936, I haven't got a clue. All I know is that Crewe is
no such option,
no more than that, right? But I could find all that knowledge out simply by going on the internet. But it doesn't make me an expert any kind of notion of historical analysis of Crewe football team at the time, or the social context of that period. So it's being able to. In any subject discipline, let's just take example.
I remember at school
copying stuff out of books and things. I'm just copying stuff. And we had vocabulary tests. Okay, there's nothing wrong with vocabulary tests. But the point is, I never really learned this at school. And only as it, and I kind of discovered. The skill, if you write an essay, the skill is to be able to recognise in an essay you need an introduction that has got to grab attention, that's going to focus on the key things that's going to be in the essay, some illustration, some statistic, some short story, etc. And then that you start to build up a body of evidence, of knowledge, of linked facts and opinions, and being able to separate fact from opinion, and that's the body of your essay. And then you've got to extract some kind of conclusion, possibly a recommendation, possibly leaving some key questions. The skill is doing that, isn't it? That once you understand what skillful writing is, it's then a question of acquiring knowledge. So let's translate this into teaching kids, say, English.
Yep.
In school. 11, 12, 13-year-old kids are going to be interested in a lot of things that we might not be interested in. They may not be interested in kind of classical English literature. I mean, I certainly wasn't, and I still am not. But I was massively interested in astronomy as a kid. I was massively interested in fishing as a kid. I would really have liked to have been in English classes where interested in fishing and football, of course. I mean, that's given. And say, right, okay, well, let's you get some books on football. It could be the history of football, it could be the skills of the game, in fact various things about football, and read that stuff. then had writing assignments that are about football and practicing speaking, talking about football. What's my favourite team? What makes it my favourite team? How does this team play? You can really good skills in reading and writing and football, and you can build vocabulary into that. I remember a game. I think you're probably old and young enough to remember this. England were playing Denmark in a game of football, and at the end of the match, they were speaking to the Danish players about Denmark won the game, incidentally. And what was interesting, I think it was for someone like that, so, well, we penetrated through the defence and we, you know, differentiated our midfield formation. And they were using these kind of complex terms. And then they interviewed, it was an English, I won't name him, it's not fair. But when they interviewed him, it was, oh, well, man, you know, where we didn't get the ball much. Not only did the Danes out football, they were even better at speaking English. Now, obviously,
yeah, the point is there
that you can build in to any topic.
You can build more differentiated,
a wider.
You can teach
good growth.
Well,
so that's
the integration and your punctuation
styles and whatever really makes sense. So teach the skills of writing.
Now you can't just make it
about football, but you can get them to.
In the world, in the families,
in the community, you know, what they see on TV, even talking about
things that you can
get
actually want to read,
write, and talk about. And to me, that's the way to develop mainly
all the skills,
including the speaking skills, the listening skills, all of those skills. And the skills that industry want. They want people who can write well, can read well, and can speak well, and have an understanding of interpersonal communication and, you know, the ability to show empathy, listening, all these kinds of things. But
it's the curriculum.
Right. So I think it really just ties everything that we've been doing up to the 50, like I'm not even what episode we are at right now. But I think it brings and ties everything together. And let me try and give you a thought on this. So in the days where knowledge maybe wasn't so easy to attain via the internet and so forth, I still remember when I was writing my thesis, having to go to the library and pulling out dusty journals. Today, I don't even need to make a trip down to the library. Journals are all at my fingertips. And I think last week, we even talked about ChatGPT. It can even create an outline for me. And then all I need to do is just fill in with my own thoughts and critical thinking. So this is where I think teaching and learning, or learning specifically, has shifted quite a fair bit. It's the reduction of content is to some extent freeing up time to allow lecturers, teachers, instructors the space to take students learning to a deeper level. So while in the early days we are looking at surface learning, oh, you need to know this is an important date for World War II, it's now shifted to, okay, give a more critical analysis of World War II. This is how you do it. You have to ask, and I think we did discuss this in one episode about models of thinking, generate some possibilities, look at the facts, and then let's critically appraise it. Giving the students the opportunity to grapple with it, lecturers or teachers or instructors giving feedback and then guiding them to act on that feedback, and then taking them onto a next component, which is, okay, now think about the way you have approached this through metacognition. And I think from last week's episode, we talked about assessment as learning, to look at how they are then now looking at their own learning processes, which is going to be very different from what we were growing up with. Would you say that is an accurate state of play when we reduce curriculum? That is what we mean when learning will change?
Yeah, in fact, you've pulled those three elements together there. I mean, let's go back to history right now. There's a lot of stuff in history. It's a big topic area, right? You've got ancient history, industrial revolution, et cetera, et cetera. It makes sense to me with children in school. Now, if they're doing an A-level history, that A-level could be medieval history. It could be very specific. About history for younger kids, and certainly if I look at the secondary sector, say 11 to 13, 14, it would make sense to let the students have a measure of choice on what they're interested in. Now, a lot of kids will say, oh, I'm interested in, you know, the Second World War because I've seen a lot of war films and what was Nazism, and, you know, why did he want to kill the Jews, and all these kind of things. So if some students are interested in the Second World War, then you can say, right, well, you work together, you know, collaboratively, you can use resources, then you put together a story of the Second World War, and you give them questions like, well, what was the basis? On what basis did Hitler actually start invading other countries? What was the philosophy? So you can bring politics in, and you know, things will come up like Nazism, fascism. You can say, well, what is fascism? Well, it's a very limited doctrine to Benvenuto Mussolini. There's not really a strong philosophical base to political right. We keep hearing things, the far right. Nobody's really defined it. And we talk about the left. The left has its a fairly scholarly, in my opinion, naive interpretation of the relationship between certain historical factors. Okay, Marxism, historical and dialectical materialism, were very powerful, clever sociological and economic concepts. But the notion of everybody, it's a nice thing, a John Lennon song, you know, imagine people sharing everything. Unfortunately, human nature isn't quite consonant with all of those things. Now, that could open up a Pandora's box, but could have students questioning, is Marxism of social change, is that relevant? Well, how does that connect with what we know about the brain and cognitive science? You can have some tremendous interest, I think, with students looking at those areas. You know, what is the nature of man? You know, we look at the world to, you can see the situation in the Ukraine, you know, there's talk of dangers of nuclear war, the environment. There's so many things for students to study historically, sociologically, psychology, and applying critical thinking all the way. How are these things connected together? Analysis. What inference and interpretations do we get from different sources of data? Evaluation, and how do we become metacognitive as beings to make sense of this, and also make sense of ourselves as living in the world? It's so rich now for a massive revolution in what we teach and how we teach.
Right.
So
we have already established that. Okay, it is not okay. We have established one. Cutting the curriculum is not dumbing it down for anyone. In fact, I think expectations have increased a lot more because now there's opportunities for, as I've said and alluded to, for teachers, instructors, lecturers to spend more time uncovering how students learn and probably giving them enough feedback and guidance, even coaching to engaging in deeper learning. Now, then we talked about the implications for teachers. Now, I want us to unpack this a little bit more. So, in light of all this, what should a teacher who is listening to this be thinking about and how they should be structuring their lessons with regards to the cut in curriculum time? And especially the fact that even in Singapore right now, a lot of schools and institutions are adopting the flipped learning model, which I'm pretty sure you are very familiar with, and a lot of people who are listening to this are very clear about what flipped learning is. So what are the implications do you think would be for teachers who are maybe new to this idea of curriculum cutting and what they need to do in the classroom? They obviously can't be deploying the same model of, even though there's a cut in curriculum, let me still continue to fill your head with knowledge.
Okay, yeah, there's a number of things, isn't there? I think Sean, content knowledge and things like this, that subjects have their own specific sets of concepts and methodologies. Well, teachers should be pretty much experts. They should be on what are the key concepts within their own subject area. Like, for example, we talk about evidence-based teaching, right?
Yep.
And there's a lot to it, but it boils, doesn't it? And one key concept is key knowledge that we now have about how the brain works and about how the mind works, and our ability to derive from that some key underpinning principles of learning. We talk about cognitive scientific principles, don't we? Activating prior knowledge. We talk about, obviously, getting students to think, and the brain is inherently lazy, but we know we've got to get students to think, because if they don't think, they don't connect stuff together, they don't build understanding. So the key concepts of evidence-based teaching is knowledge about the brain and the mind and the implications for how we design instruction. And design instruction is a key concept in teaching, isn't it? You've got to design the lesson. And then facilitation, the concept of facilitation, is a key concept in teaching. How do we pull together the concepts, instructional methods, and turn them into activities? So that's what we should be teaching in all subjects, the key concepts and principles fundamental to understanding. Good teachers, expert teachers, understand that there are things we know about learning, principles of learning. There's things we know about methods, how methods work, how to design them, which ones you can combine together, how to turn those into meaningful activities that connect to students' prior knowledge and perhaps interests, those kind of things. These are key concepts. And I did a year's PGCE at one of the, well, probably the top place in the world. I won't know. Fair to do that. And I'll be honest with you, in that one year, I really learned. I enjoyed their lectures talking about aspects of philosophy and education. And, you know, we talked about Vygotsky's zone of proximal development and that. But I went in the classroom, there was no real connection. But when you understand the way the brain works, the mind works, and you understand what methods work, those key things, it's then possible to really design effective, engaging and lessons that involve creativity, because you can bring in things that are not naturally connected. And certainly with technology today, with hyperlinking, you've got a great capability to make student learning much more interesting, much more relevant. So if we're teaching stuff that's relevant to life, to work, and we are utilizing knowledge can do that, they become the key domains for teacher education. And teachers should not be thinking about how can I get students to memorize more of the corn laws or various, you know, structures of trade. Doesn't matter. They need to understand the concept of structure, and they need to understand what a trade union is, and the concept of, you know, workers' rights, or whether you believe that they should have rights, or, you know, whatever it is, all these kind of things. So about getting students to understand the key things about each subject domain as its own kind of set of assumptions about reality. You know, what is reality? Like, you know, the they look
close, but it still boils down to,
doesn't it? Galaxies, stars, solar systems, planets, and a lot of dark matter that we still don't fully understand. So it's getting it down to key concepts, not trying to memorize the name of every star in the sky. You can have that in an almanac. You can look that up. You need to understand what a star is, what its basic composition and structure is, and how it evolves and subsequently dies, supernovas, right, black holes and things like that. So teach astronomy at that level. Then when students get interested, they will then want to go deeper if they are that interested in the subject. But that's what we should be teaching in schools, so students understand that they can read well, they can write well, they can speak well, and they can think well, and they can manage themselves better, because this self-regulation and well-being is such a big area. These are the focal areas. And, you know, the world is full of knowledge now that can be accessed, and with things like augmented and artificial intelligence coming in, and a lot of the e-tools that you talk about, really, the learning process should be made exciting, interesting, and relevant, shouldn't it?
Sure. So, having said that, now let's just maybe put a cap on this by looking at what would be the top three tips that you would give a teacher to do exactly what you just described. So, what should they be doing, or in other words, what should they be educating themselves in to be able to do what they are doing right now? Because I don't really think a lot of teacher programs for want of a better word, updated or current to the point where they are able to bring the teach less, learn more concept to life. So what would be your top three pieces of advice to teachers to be able to handle this in the classroom?
Okay, well, I mean, the first thing is they've got to be look, if you want to write well, you've got to be pretty literate, right? Okay. If you want to teach well, you've got to be pedagogically literate. There's people now who have done teacher training 30 years ago. Oh, I trained as a teacher. I'm trained. Well, okay. Well, 200 years ago, when doctors went round with bottles of whiskey and sores and leeches, can they then claim, oh, no, yeah, I should be working in a top hospital now doing surgery? I mean, it's a joke, isn't it? And also, as you know, in the books written, I've talked about educational Jurassic Park and a lot of teacher education, and I'm saying this, I don't care what criticism I get, but a lot of teacher education has been Jurassic Park, kind of the current vogue of social constructivism, and constructivism is not a theory of learning, just to be able to say, well, everybody learns in their own unique ways and learning styles, which we now know is definitely Jurassic Park, is not a basis for high level professional knowledge. Teacher education should be now about drawing from what we know about the way the mind works, which is massive. The brain, things work together. We should really have a scientific base. People say like engineering and medicine. I'm not quite sure it's going to get there or can get there, but that there should be a much more evidence-based approach to teaching. So that's one thing. Once that happens, then teachers then need to have the freedom, and this is where there has to be change at the level of exam boards. If exams are demanding that students learn a lot of stuff that is not seen as relevant by employers, not seen as interesting by students, teachers are, in a sense, stuck. It's like, well, we know what we want to teach now. We can teach better. We can teach in more interesting ways. But we've got to teach stuff that students don't seem as relevant and employers don't seem as relevant. So there's got to be a change at the level of national curriculum, certainly. And what has to come in is all the things we're talking about, the metacognition, the focus on good thinking, and the curriculum content being organized around key concepts and principles. So that are things that have got to happen. Teachers themselves to really look at how current they are in terms of pedagogic literacy, also in terms of the skillfulness that they have in using more and more method blending and using the technologies in a pedagogically sound way. So there's need for significant professional development. I'm not saying there aren't a lot of teachers who are good at this now, but that needs to be right across the profession. We don't want a few surgeons who are very good, do we? We don't want many surgeons who can't do the surgery they're required. So we need to have an heightened teaching force right across the board. We need to have significant changes in the structure and the components and content of curriculum. There are two major things, definitely. No.
Okay. Can I also suggest that, of course, this is a shameless plug on our podcast for those of you who are thinking of doing it in your own classrooms, to please refer back to previous episodes where we talked a little bit about metacognition, some learning to learn strategies that you can also teach your students, because I think this is something that they need help with. And I mean students need help with from their teachers, because don't assume that all students are able to learn effectively. And also, I just want to clarify a concept here. I think there's also, as I talk to quite a number of people, there seems to be some misconception when we say students need to be self-directed. It means simply students learning by themselves. I don't think that is the whole accurate description of what self-directed learning is. So I think this also serves to what you said about being pedagogically literate. So I think that that to me means really understanding what learning means and what certain terms that we use, and sometimes even I'm guilty of it, too interchangeably to mean different things. So I think for me, what would be one top tip would be is really to help students look at the information and then get them to engage in critical thinking. And you, the lecturer, instructor, or teacher, should model that behavior for students up to a point where they become quite used to these kind of questions and looking at how you model that behavior. And then start to engage in what I would call giving good feedback, helping them act on that feedback, and then finally closing the loop by actually getting them to engage in some form of metacognition. So that's my little model. I think there might be a potential paper right there that we can write then.
Well, it's more than a little model, Mark. I mean, it together a lot of key strands about what we know about learning, isn't it? And I mean, those kind of things need to happen. It's really important that we don't fall into this kind of, if you like, spectrum between discovery learning and rigid formal instruction. Yep. Right? Discovery learning is kind of okay in certain situations, but students to develop good understanding need, which is key concepts. They need to have a range of stimuluses, activities around that, so that they can see examples of it, non-examples. They need to have a decent understanding of something. So say to students, I want you to be metacognitive. You might as well be talking to your dog, right? Okay, you know, and expect it to, oh, Rover, please don't soil the carpet. Unless you've trained that dog in certain ways, that if it wants to go to the toilet, it behaves in a certain way and you take it out the garden and it goes. You've got to teach the dog to do it first. And then the dog does it. The dog isn't going to sit there and say, I have choices now. I can mess the carpet, or I can go in the area that I know I'm supposed to go. Doesn't do that. It's instinctive. As human beings, a lot of our behavior ultimately seems to boil down to doing those things and be metacognitive about it and choose not to. So that's a big difference. So we've got to teach students that metacognition is a capability that humans have, how it works, purposes it can get us to say, hold on a minute, emotionally I feel I want to do this, but maybe I don't know enough about it. Let's think about it, analyze it, let's get some more information. So it's a fundamental skill that needs a lot of modeling, a lot of examples, and hopefully that once students are familiar with how it works and they do their deliberate practice and they get feedback, then they're up and running with it, aren't they? But we've got to teach these key skills and key knowledge about how the mind works and sometimes doesn't work well, what the barriers are and how you manage the barriers. All of this really, I think psychology, aspects of psychology that we've now derived from a lot of research on the brain and mind, this should be a school subject because it underpins everything else. I'm absolutely convinced of that.
Okay, so that nicely wraps up our first part, talking a little bit about the implications of cutting curriculum. And it doesn't mean that we dumb it down, but it actually means that more focus on the actual learning process is going to be important. So let's move on to part two, which is again my favorite part of the entire podcast, talking about something that we may have read, something that we may have done, or something that we may have come across to share with the audience. So do you want to go first then?
Well, again, we did this podcast. Only seems we did did we do it on Friday last week?
Yeah, we did.
And it's what, Tuesday today. What has happened since then? I'm sure I'll tell you what's happened for me. I've had a good old fashioned English cold, which I've not had for 30 years, let me add. I never, ever had a cold in. Do people get colds in?
Yes.
Do that. I never had one. I never had a cold. And I was lucky, having been back in the UK for a couple of years, I've not had COVID yet. And I've not had a cold, but the last two or three days I've been sneezing and coughing, and not so much coughing, but certainly sneezing. And beginning to abate. And that's about it. And I did watch that kind of bit of palliative relief. So I can't say I can contribute anything to your favourite section this week. So apologies on that count.
Right. So for me is, last week we talked a little bit about the rising importance of artificial intelligence, yeah, and ChatGPT. So I've been exploring it a bit more, and I've come across this little guide or handbook that says how ChatGPT can be used for teaching and learning. I'm not going to go through this because it's a bit long, but what I'll do is I will put the whole document prompts on the online for as in part of the show notes, so that lecturers or teachers can download it and use it to explore, to you know, to enhance their teaching and learning methods. So it is again going to be quite important, and I do anticipate that moving forward in the next few weeks, I would probably be sharing a lot more of these kind of resources, especially for you as a teacher who is looking to explore the use of AI in your own classrooms. So yeah, so that's my little sharing for the week. Little prompts or guides to help you exploit the use of ChatGPT in your own classroom. Yeah, so that's it from for my sharing for the week. Anything to look forward to for the rest of the week then?
What am I doing? I'm doing some work at the moment to help students learn better, all the things that we're talking about, the learning strategies, thinking skills, self-regulation skills, and also managing themselves as people. I mean, young people today have so many areas of distraction that to actually study for exams where very often the subject content doesn't seem terribly interesting or meaningful is a real challenge. So my next 10 weeks major project is to help a group of students to develop this, if you like, metacognitive capability that I use, and that is to, you know, manage themselves, their thinking, their emotions, their beliefs, stay, you know, in a positive mindset, find out what they need to learn, make sure they learn it, develop understanding. And that involves things that, you know, that you have mentioned in the past, like managing your teacher, that, you know, if you're sitting in class, don't understand, if you don't address that in some way, that it's not going to suddenly come into your head in the exam. The brain don't work that way. You've got to have it neurologically wired, and you've got to do the repeated practice and the deliberate practice with exam questions. So I'm going to work with the students, those who want to put a shift in, to see just how well we can actually infuse those skills into the curriculum. That invariably what we want is teachers to be able to, right across all subjects, to have that level of pedagogic literacy to be able to say to students, right, I want you to do some analysis now and be able to model what good analysis is. I want you to do evaluation now, model what that is, be able to say, right, I want you to be metacognitive, and students know what that means. Slow down, let's think about what we're doing. Have we done good thinking? Are we missing something? Are we letting our biases come into play? All those kind of things. So that's where education needs to get to. Will it get to there in my lifetime? Maybe yours, I don't know. But I mean, that's why we do this stuff, right?
Right. Okay, so thanks for sharing that. So once again, everyone, we hope you have enjoyed today's session. And if you do know of someone who may benefit from listening to this podcast, please do share the link with them. And as always, you can write to us at evidencebasedcreativeteaching@gmail.com. Once again, evidencebasedcreativeteaching@gmail.com. So thank you very much for spending your time with us today. We have enjoyed ourselves as usual, and we look forward to the next episode where I'm not sure what we're going to talk about, but I'm sure we'll think of something. So take care, everyone, and we'll speak to you soon. So take care and goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me.